So I'm here, my wife and I are here in February, our first time in February, because I retired last May. This is a little loud. I have a pretty big voice. I probably don't even need it at all. I get elbowed a lot from Dan at the restaurant. So we're here in February because I retired in May. So I had been teaching with my college in Santa Barbara for 35 years. And so that frees up February, and everybody wants to come to Victoria in February. So here we are. But part of retiring is that it encourages you to look back. Well, what was my life like at Westmont? 35 years, that's half my life, almost, at least on Wednesday. It'll be half my life. So what is important? How do I characterize the life that I have led? So what I want to do today is kind of walk through some aspects of my life as pilgrimage, and in that way encourage you to be thinking about your life as pilgrimage. It'll be a little bit of an unusual kind of a sermon, mainly story-driven and working on that verse that Tim put up. So I want to start. This didn't get me going here, back there. Are we there? No. Try it again. Oh boy, well, you can kind of see it. So I'm going to start actually before we were in Santa Barbara. So this is when we were in Eugene. I got my doctorate in Eugene. And we lived there for 10 years. So we have web feed and we know a little bit about writing. This was our 900 square foot house that we raised two of our children in. Emily was born when we were there. And in the summer of 1987, I was driving from Eugene, Oregon to start my job as an assistant professor at Westmont. Janet was already in California because she was 8 months pregnant. We decided maybe she should get there so she didn't deliver on the way. And I was driving down with our house plants and few odds and ends, right? Somebody has to do it, in our 1972 Ford Pinto. You know, the one that that blew up if you rear-ended it, that one. It was actually Janet's mom's car, and we borrowed it when we got married. That's on our honeymoon. Everybody wears overalls on their honeymoon, right? And actually, people wear overalls now at college. So I wish I'd saved mine. And anyway, she gave it to us later, and now I was driving it down. But my nickname for this car was Car. Car. It had no emergency brake, no interior light, no driver's armrest, no overhead light, no horn, no air conditioner in the 100-degree heat. And on the way down to Santa Barbara, in Northern California, the radio room. So this was a basic car. All right. And so I just said, car, you know, hey, honey, I'm leaving today. I'm going to take car. All right. So we were starting our Westmont adventure and we were excited. That's not going off. There we go. We were excited about that and thrilled to be returning to California where we both grew up. And so now that I'm kind of starting to reflect out loud with you about these 35 years, let's look at this verse that Tim already mentioned. How do I frame my life? Okay, so how do I think about what I am doing day to day and where I am going? And who I am going with. So those are pretty basic questions for everybody, whether you're in the church or not in the church. All right. Where are you going? Who are you going with? What's your purpose along the way? So blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. Is our life a search for happiness? That's the main thing that we're about. Is that kind of a survivor game show? Go set in the lava. That's the one our kids, grandkids like the best. Is it a curated marketing campaign, you know, on Instagram, and how you present yourself is about how you market yourself, all about your appearance and your good time. The psalmist suggests it's a pilgrimage. Actually, it was taken right above where we currently live on a, what's called the San Marcos Preserve, gorgeous linnet green. And it's currently lush and beautiful. So what is a pilgrimage? And you're walking on a path. It's an intentional walk. It's not a stroll, but it's a high commitment hike. It's something that requires strength, the psalmist says, but strength in the Lord. What does that mean? It's a journey that isn't just about the journey. I mean, the journey is important, but it's not just about the journey. It's also about the destination. And to be on a pilgrimage means to be a pilgrim. Now, that's an old word we don't use too much, but we remember Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called Pilgrim's Regress. So what does it mean to be a pilgrim, a wayfarer of the soul toward Jesus, to be searching for that holy place? So to get us thinking about life as pilgrimage, I'm going to tell you some stories about my life. And I don't really care whether you remember my life. I want you to think about yours and what it would mean to characterize your life as pilgrimage. So I'm going to tell you four stories, three of them pretty short, and some things that happened along the way. And then God met me, even when I had an afro. He didn't desert me. I just have to tell you, I really, really miss my hair. I mean, it was really good. In its time, he loved me even when I was taking photographs with my lion mane back in the day, and even when I taught class in a tutorial. So yeah, done some different things. But let's look at four stories, all right? Three brief stories, one long story. The first brief story, in 1987, driving down to Santa Barbara in the Pinto, I was hired at Westmont, and I was 34, and I really didn't feel like I had found my vocation. That's a long time to wait, and maybe you think I've waited longer than that. But no, I've sure worked hard. I've got a doctorate. I've done this. I've taught here. When am I going to really get into a place where I think that this is my calling? And it was a rough start. So we had, when we first moved to Santa Barbara, our Janet was pregnant with our third, and she had our third in July, right before I started. So we had three kids under 3 and a half. Okay. And we lived in a house that needed a ton of work. Our newborn got meningitis and was in NICU for a week, 5 days. I had 5 new crafts. I was just working like a madman. And my mom died. So it was rough. It was a rough beginning. But the Westmont classroom greatly exceeded my expectations. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God. This is what I was made to do. I mean, right away. It's not like I had to wait 5 years. It was right away. And I thought, this is what all of this 34 years of preparation was about. So God met me in that moment and showed me my vocation. And we prospered. Eventually, things got better. And in 3 years, we could afford pizza. Emily remembers. I was learning. Oh, there we are. Sorry, I forgot to show that one. So Emily's in the middle there, and Anna and Emily. Yeah. All right. So coming back to the verse, blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. At times, my heart was set on success. At times, my heart was set on being well-regarded, on money, on leisure, on and on. Right? But here, what the psalmist is calling us to do is to have our heart set on pilgrimage. What does that mean? So, my second story. Let's go to 2011. Our first grandchild, is about to be born, Miriam. And because it was summer, we had the leisure to take a road trip and drive up from Santa Barbara. We ended up buying a car, and right before we left and driving up. Anybody have a Hyundai Elantra in here? Okay, well, I don't know. It was a very bad experience. So you might have had a great experience. So we bought this car in Los Angeles, and by the time we got it home in Santa Barbara in LA, I mean, back in Santa Barbara, 2 hours from LA, I was a sweaty mess. My back was on fire. It was just an ergonomic disaster for me. I called the dealer as soon as we arrived. I said, can we bring this car back? I hate it. And he said, no, you can't. Once you drive it off the lot, it's yours.
Well, thank you.
So we decided, I decided that we would drive it to Vancouver. Janet said, you know, your back is so hurting so much, why don't we rent a car? Well, that was way too reasonable. I mean, we had actually purchased the car. We were going to drive this car. So that's what we did. I was in total agony the entire way. I mean, I was just squirming. It was awful. In fact, my nickname for this car was Stinging. When we got back, I was in serious back pain for 2 years. 2 years. I was often in the fetal position on the carpet. That is the best I could do. I have a habit of naming my summer, and I named that summer the summer that I swept the back porch, because that's all I could do. My pain level was often at a 7 or an 8. Sometimes it goes down to a 6 or a 5. And my days were filled with dread. All I could think about was the pain. In fact, I wondered, could I live my day though in this much pain? I didn't know if I could. Well, through some really important reading, I learned that I needed emotional healing, spiritual healing, as well as physical healing. So I prayed for God to make these changes in me. And for the first time in my life, I went to a counselor. So during our first visit, of course, she asked about my childhood. And she discovered that my parents had been alcoholics for 20 years. And I mean alcoholics. My parents drank to drunkenness every single night, no exceptions, for 20 years. My mom got cirrhosis. She died. So then she said, well, when did you first have back pain? I said, oh, you know, somewhere around 11 years old. And she said, well, what happened? You fall off a horse, were you in a car accident? I mean, 10 years old with back pain? I mean, there has to be some precipitating event. And I said, no, there was no precipitating event. Huh. She said, so when did your parents start drinking the drunkenness? And I said, God, well, I had never thought of that. It was a major revelation. It had never crossed my mind. I was stunned. I kind of stumbled out of the office and just sat in my car for a while before I drove home. And suddenly, I had no pain. No pain. For the first time in a year and a half, I received as a gift 24 hours of no pain. So I learned that part of my pain was emotional and I needed to work on that. And my pain did decrease gradually. And 6 months later, I was no longer in the fetal position. And here I am today. That felt, well, I didn't just feel like a miracle. It was a miracle. So I was learning again that blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. Whether I'm in pain, out of pain. The point is pilgrimage, that I'm on this journey with Christ. It's not just that I'm free of pain. So here's my third story. This summer, Jen and I will have been married 47 years. Actually, you should say cheers to her. It's a lot more work for her than it is for me. Early in our dating life, I realized I would be a lousy monk. Glad I didn't live in the Middle Ages. I needed to be married. And at the time, you know, I thought I was quite a catch. You know, I had a lot going for me and a pretty talented guy. I mean, except for my impatience and driven perfectionism and my loose-tongued criticism and my volatility, I was the guy, you know? So I met Janet, we dated. Oh no, you haven't seen that one already. No, you don't want to see it, take that. There we are, about an engaged. I should love my hair. I mean, look at that hair. Our hair is kind of the same. Only who's the straight line curly? All right. So we dated, fell in love, got married. There we are, in white. And we did well. You know, it wasn't perfect, but we stayed together and loved each other and grew together. We had three daughters and we did our best. But one day I was listening to a sermon, and what that proved that morning was that people listen to sermons and learn things from them sometimes. Okay, so I was listening to a sermon on the fruit of the Spirit. There they are on the banner. And the pastor was going through this, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And it struck me that Janet was better at every single one of these than I. I wasn't like she had three, I had four. No, 7-0. And I'm competitive. So I had a lot to learn. My tree to bear fruit needed a lot of fertilizer and water and pruning. And God met me in this. Oops. There we are today. God met me in this marriage. And helped me to grow. And I could see that Janet was a kind of fruit of the Spirit mentor for me. And I don't know that she'd say I really learned much, but I'm trying. And I think I'm bearing more fruit. But God met me. I have a companion for life, and God answered my prayer. And I was learning. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. I was kind of a pilgrim in marriage, a pilgrim on the road of life. So what does it mean for you to think of your life as a pilgrim? What kind of shifting might occur if that were the case? All right, so here's the main story I want to tell you. So those are just three little introductory ones. This story is from 1971. It's Christmas break of my freshman year. My parents had moved out of our really cool, great family house. They didn't ask us if they could move. They just sold the house. Bought a really ugly, dilapidated, dark apartment. It was hideous. I hated that place. It was Christmas Eve. My brother and his girlfriend were there for a little while. My sister and her boyfriend were there for a little while. I didn't have a girlfriend, so I just sat there being lonely and full of self-pity. And we exchanged a little bit of gifts. My brother left with his girlfriend. My sister left with her boyfriend. And I was there with my parents, who, of course, were drunk. So I'm going to tell you this story in the form in which I have written it. I'm working on a novel, which is part memoir and part invented story, called Boomer Boys, coming to a stand near you sometime. And the only thing that's not true about this theme is that I have rewritten it in as if it took place in Santa Barbara. But other than that, the theme is true. So it's a the novel that's kind of passed through and happened then. Having nowhere to go, I sat staring at the carpet, brushing the chocolate-colored shag this way and that. Dad stumbled down the hall toward the bathroom, bumping against the walls before pausing at the door. He smiled stupidly at me, like this was charming, like he was about to sing Frank Sinatra's I've Got the World on a String. Fat chance he couldn't even find his zipper. That left Mom and me in the living room. She sat on our turquoise floral sofa, its polyester fabric, the only indestructible thing in the house. After Dad left, she decided she needed to get up also. Gallo hearty burgundy in hand. She pushed against the sofa, rose a few inches, and flopped back down, her cheap jug lines flashing on her pan. She laughed. I clenched my teeth and narrowed my eyes. It galls me how drunks think they're funny. But most drunken deeds are just funny to the drunk or to the naive who haven't yet lived. Mom filled her glass again and lurched up to a wobbly squat, teetering precariously, and leaned into a slow motion dive down, down toward the floor. She belched as she lost her balance, stretched out her arms to break the fall, and belly flopped onto the carpet with a moan, her wine spraying out and soaking into the shack. There was my mom, totally gone, totally wasted, passed out at my feet. In that moment, I did not wonder if she was okay, if I should call 911 or if I should stick around and help. No, I shook my head with disgust and headed for my 1960 Red Rambler, the car that broke down whenever I had a little cash. Thankfully, it started. The truth was, I had nowhere to go. It was Christmas Eve. So I just drove. I went down Curio, over the freeway, up State Street. I just drove and drove. Finally, up the hill with the Baptist church on top for the view that I'd once made out with the pastor's daughter in the parking lot brought little solace now. The pastor caught singing. Though the radio played God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, I was numb. I recited my time-honored litany of woes of nights in my room waiting for the family TV to stop so I knew it was safe to come out. Of sloshy words and 90-proof breath, of moldy food on the stove and the fridge and the trash can, of the grand total of 3 words a week of human contact from my dad, and on and on. I grew tired. So I started the car and drove down Patsfoot Hill and La Cumbre Plaza, down, down, all roads in Santa Barbara, eventually leading to the beach. On the way, I saw a familiar street and felt compelled to take it. The pastor's daughter lived out there. We weren't a thing anymore, but I knew the whole family, and I wanted to drive by the place so I could pause, look longingly at it, and sigh. As I got close, I opened the window and stared at the house. I mean, at nothing in particular, just like on the eaves, just a lit window beneath, a lit tree in that window. I felt the fullness of my thigh, and I let it go. I motored off. I turned left at the first tree and paused at the corner, and then left again, and left again, again, until by some hallmark miracle, there I was, slowly coasting by their house once more. I put my arm out the window and flattened my hand on the slick, cold metal of the car door. I saw shadows by their Christmas tree. I lingered and sighed again and left. At the cross street, I did not hesitate, as if I had no choice. I turned left and left again and left again and again, like Sisyphus on wheels, and I eased my rambler back up to the same curve, stuck in a loop I could not, would not pull out. I stopped there and idled while my mind raced. All the sour Christmases, all the holidays awash with booze. I might have prayed. I don't remember. I might have said, help. Something at the house caught my eye. Mrs. Ellison stepped out and waved me in. She motioned for me to come in. I waved her off. But she beckoned to me again, and I said in my head, I have nowhere to come. I stared out the windshield and measured the depth of my desperation. And then got out of the car and faced the house. I have nowhere to go, I repeated. So I walked to her, so sheepish I couldn't fall. At the porch, Mrs. Ellison reached her arm out over my shoulder to half hug, half pull me in. I lowered my head. I knew they didn't like my long hair or my wayward ways with their daughter. But she kept her arm outstretched, and she held it there till I came fully under it. With my head bowed, my chin tucked in, my cheek on the fuzzy snowman of her gaudy Christmas sweater, I felt her momness and the tip of her shepherd's crook hugging my sheepishness and pride. I don't know how else to say it, but I sensed something alien and electric, something otherworldly, maybe holy. Glory shone all around, and Mrs. Ellison told me not to be afraid as she took me into the house. There, around the tree, the family looked as if they'd been put on pause. Torn wrapping littered the carpet. A red bow dangled from the dog's neck. The 9-year-old boy flashed a smile at me and froze, his hand rocking back and forth in a robotic way. No, I said to myself, this is their Christmas. They are opening presents. I can't imagine. I nodded hello and sat out of the way in the dining room chair. I smiled weakly a few times, but mostly I tried to be there without being there, not to interrupt them. And I watched the family that they were and mine wasn't. The kids laughing and teasing Mrs. Ellison until she gave them major stink eye. As much as I wished I could blend into the wallpaper and watch, I knew that because I was there, they weren't the family that they would have been without me. And I did not take their welcome lightly. So I soaked up all of that mercy. I held it as long as I could. And I said my thing, and I slipped out. The cool night air caught me by the shoulders and turned my head to the sky. The stars were so brilliant, any magi at all. I stood in the middle of the street, drinking it in, gulping down the whole galaxy. I know it sounds crazy, but the stars seemed to whisper my name. And when I leaned up, I sensed they wanted me to remember this moment, this paradise, and to spend my life circling back, round and round, till I returned, not to this house, but to this place I rarely knew, home. So there are four stories of my pilgrimage. Again, I don't really care that you know about my pilgrimage. I want you to think about yours and what it would mean to frame your life as a pilgrimage. So Jesus walked with me. He showed me my vocation. He healed me from pain. He led me to a wife. He rescued me from despair. But, you know, talking about pilgrimage like that isn't really quite right. I mean, maybe you sense that. Because a pilgrimage is not mainly about being victorious, but getting what you want. It's not about triumph. Yes, God answered my prayers in these cases in the ways that I wanted, but lots of times I don't get the answer that I want. Like when my student, Patrick Steele, got flipped in a skit and became quadriplegic. Or when one of my daughters was depressed for years, and 100 other requests. On a pilgrimage, most of the time, it's not triumph, but transformation. It's not just about making it to the end and getting what we want. It's about being changed on the way as we walk toward that thing that we're walking toward. So let's review these stories. Story one, yes, the Holy Spirit guided me to my vocation, but more than that, he stimulated my faith by showing me that he was trustworthy. All those years, I thought, really? Really? Point was that he was trustworthy. God met me and transformed me. Story number two, yes, Jesus, the good doctor, healed my back. But more than that, he humbled my sense of achievement and effectiveness. If you are a confirmed achievaholic, as I am, and you are on the fetal, in the fetal position on the carpet for about 2 years, you ain't gonna get much. God made me sensitive to other sufferers, including himself on the cross. God met me and transformed me. Story number three. Yes, God gave me the desire of my heart for a spouse, but more than that, he used that relation to refine me, to show me my need for recurring forgiveness, the need to love my neighbor, my wife, as myself, and to become a more loving person by following her lead. God met me and transformed me. Story four, yes, God helped the pastor's wife to see me and invite me in, dealing with my despair with an hour of grace and hope to lift me up. But more importantly, I thank God the Father, through this mother, showed himself ready to welcome me home. Not because I've done anything to deserve this grace, but because of who he is and that he loves me. God met me and transformed me. By seeing myself as a pilgrim on a pilgrimage, I interpret circumstances differently. I cast them differently. I frame them differently. My pilgrimage has taught me that God is less in the business of taking things away. Oh God, take this away. Take away this pain. Take away this problem. And he's much more in the business of dealing redemptively with broken circumstances and teaching me, training me, ultimately taking me. Again, God's primary goal is not to take things away, but to take me. Not to take things away, but to take me, to take you, to forgive us, to make us like Jesus, living in freedom, able to walk on our pilgrimage and keep walking by his strength toward a holy goal. Blessed are those whose strength is in the Lord.